Good morning. So, first off, clearly the assignment two is not due Wednesday. So, let's talk about deadlines. Can you all see that very well? I can't see that very well, so how can you guys see that well? Can you see that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. So, we're sitting here on February 12th. So, next week is winter break. Right now, the midterm is scheduled for the 28th. So, my thought is I want to push the midterm to March 5th, to the Monday, and have the assignment two due on the 28th. So you have the 26th to ask questions about it, and then after you get the solutions on the 28th, and then you have the weekend, and you can ask me questions on my Slack if you have things, but solutions come out on the 28th. So first off, that's the schedule. I will get assignment two up today. I've just been doing other things, but so that's kind of the schedule for that. The thing I am more concerned about actually is your experiences. I know some of you are having real difficulties with the experiences, which kind of confuses me, because the idea of the experiences is it's supposed to be spend 2 to 4 hours doing something in a general direction and tell me how it goes. That's basically what I'm looking for. Some of you have very little background in a certain area. Some of you have lots. I don't expect you all to get to the same place. That's why these are not assignments, in part. I want you to go in a direction and satisfy your curiosity and learn something hands-on. That's the point of the experiences. And I'm talking about all kinds of technologies here and different things. Anything I talk about, something related to that, you can make an experience out of. I'm pretty open-minded about it. And if you want to propose one, as long as it's reasonable, I much more prefer things on the defensive side than the offensive side, but I am certainly open to offensive sides. I said something. So some people have asked about doing password cracking. Sure. Rootkits, sure. I mean, again, that's all fine. The trick is I need you to actually do something. I think of two basic splits in this class. One split, most of what I talk about in this class, you're going like, yeah, I kind of get that, and I'm giving you a little bit of extra information, a little bit of context. I expect that's about 10, maximum 20% of you. Some of the rest of you kind of go like, okay, I've heard that before. It's kind of nice to hear about that in a little more context. And then most of you are probably going like, whoa. So I'm not getting enough questions to slow me down, so I'm just sort of going ahead with things. And I know a lot of you don't understand this stuff. So you gotta let me know. And you gotta use the experiences to help bring up, your background knowledge. Because that's how you learn about this stuff. You have to be self-directed. You're all fourth-year students. Once you leave here, people are not going to be making up exercises for you to learn things. You're going to have to go out and just learn it. Going, oh yeah, I don't understand that technology. Let me go figure it out. And you'll have to figure out exercise your own, goals of your own to do that. That's all I'm looking for with these experiences. You say, I would really like to learn, I'd like to learn Angular. You want to learn Angular? You'd probably make a little app or something and try to do that. Oh, what sort of app would I make? Oh, I don't know, maybe I'll try making a little game. I mean, you'd make something up and you'd do it. That's what I'm looking here, just do something related to security. And there's a lot. So what I'm gonna do today is I'm gonna be a little more hands-on than I have been up to here, and I think going forward I'll probably be more. And I've gotta be doing one, and then I think two things, and we'll see how it goes. The first thing I want to do is, I'm kind of trying to demonstrate by doing, is do a little experience of my own.
and maybe you all can help me out.
Which is my wiki. My wiki is not protected by HTTPS. And I did have at one point, I did at one point have a certificate for it. It expired. I did not want to pay for it again because it just bugs me. I mean to get Let's Encrypt working on my machine, and I haven't. So I'm going to try doing that right now. And I want you to watch as I go. And this is the kind of thing I'm expecting you to do for an experience. Like, oh, wouldn't that be nice to play? How does that Let's Encrypt stuff work? I've looked at Let's Encrypt before. I've actually set it before, so this should go a bit quicker for me than you all. Again, it's supposed to scale to your experience. Now, I'll say right now, if you haven't done at least three by the midterm, you're in real trouble. I mean, this is 20% of your grade. And if you try shoving it in towards the end of the term, I know how many other things are coming due. You know, we won't be able to give you much credit for what you turn in. And it's just, it's not going to be pretty. And I don't want to be, you know, just having you all lose lots of marks for something that should be relatively straightforward. So Let's Encrypt. So, you know, can I? I can't do that. But I can do this. Okay, so. Ooh. I'm locked, so I had to become myself in order to be able to SSH. So why did I have to become me in order to SSH into my box?
Access for your key.
So let me that we should be able to scroll up. So I just want to show you here. So first I type SSH as homeostasis and it said permission denied public key. Did it ask me for a password? It's not asking me for a password. So what does that mean? Normally, when you SSH into a box, it asks you for a password, right? Default configuration. Though if you've been playing with VM configured boxes, you'll see that's not the case always. What's happened is password authentication has been turned off. So I can't log in with typing my password. I have to use my key. So my key, I could have copied over from my other account, but instead I just became, you know, the user which has the key in my SSH authorized keys, you know, SSH, you know, ID RSA dot pub, well, ID to RSA. Anyway, so I'm in my box. I just update in security because if I see a box that's not updated, then it's like. Now, let's look at. So my wiki now. My wiki is not protected by SSL, TLS. How should I go about doing this? What's the basic strategy for what I need to do here?
I Google how to set up. We browse the first couple posts.
Okay, now, so first off, what am I actually running here? Do you all know what web server I'm running? Well, actually, the way, turns out if you go to the top page, well, that doesn't say anything, it still doesn't tell you. How could I figure out what web server is running on my system? Just out of curiosity, how could I?
Check services.
Check services.
For example, Apache, when you're running Apache, if you check like the running services, you can check.
So, well, check the process list. Services is kind of a Windows concept. Okay. Well, actually, also.
NetStat, and see what's using port 80.
Well, NetStat doesn't tell processes.
It does.
It does?
Which
is it a P?
I think you have to run it as sudo to get the.
You think? No, I'm not. Oh, there we go. Yeah. What did it say before? You're right. It did not say that. Okay, and so, but here we... Okay. That's a cool trick. I haven't tried that. I know LSOF. I was going to try doing that, but this is definitely simpler. Oh, no, this is not it. This just tells me the service name, I think. Where is... Wait, no, that's no program name. What was that program? MySQL D, DSM, SSHD, CUPSD, MongoD. Oh, no, it is giving me my processes. Okay. And Apache 2. Mm-hmm. Oh. Someone take notes. Okay. Missing easy marks here. Okay, so. So we know it's Apache. Now I could have, I mean, I actually knew that already because if it's your web server, you should know what you're running. It's kind of a good thing. So, but, and of course if I definitely got lots of Apache files. So all my configurations are in Apache, it's etc Apache 2. So here's all my configuration files here. Basically the strategy you have to do in order to get TLS working on a modern web server is you have to do two things. One is you have to get a key, basically get your public-private key pair. Get your public-private key pair with your public key, i.e. your certificate, signed by a respected certificate authority. If it's not signed by a respected certificate authority, you get a self-signed certificate. And they get, basically your self-signed certificate is, well, let's play with the self-signed certificate. Let's try doing that and I can show you what errors you get. And then I can show you, okay, let's try getting something a little more legit. So, if I go to sites available, okay, and now if we look at, I have an SSL configuration for this. So it says virtual host 443. What happens if I actually try accessing that? Okay, so it does have, there is SSL working, but you get this. So I actually don't even have to show you. So advanced. Is use an invalid certificate. Expired. Okay, add exception. So view. So you see I have a certificate here. It expired in 2014. I had a GoDaddy certificate. It's been a few years. So okay, I actually have already configured my box for being SSL enabled. So it's natural to look here at, so what is it doing here? So mostly the stuff here is document root is here, follow symlinks, allow override. Now all the best, this is kind of standard configuration, but then there's all this SSL stuff. SSL engine on, SSL certificate in, SSL. See, okay, dot cert, certificate chain is here, certificate key file is here. So it's saying something about files there, so those files presumably exist. LSSSL, permission denied. Why is permission denied? Because you don't want most things accessing your certificate, because that allows them to impersonate your machine. Now, of course, this is basically a single user box. That's not so much, but like the SSL will notice that's only accessible by root. Now, so Apache is not running as root. It's running as www-data. Yet, these files are owned by root. So right there, you should be going like, wait a second. Well, let's rare. Okay. So you see, these files are... Oh yeah, I left myself a note. This is something that's always good to do. If you have some obscure command that you have to run to do something, it's nice to leave little notes to yourself. Now you could say, let me make separate documentation, but let's face it, the best documentation are the documentation that shows up right when you're trying to do the task. So, like, now, of course, this is set to generate a self-signed certificate to do these commands, which are still valid. But again, I don't want a self-signed certificate because instead of it being signed by GoDaddy or just be signed by myself, then I get exactly the same error. Except I wouldn't get certificate expired. I'll just say self-signed certificate. But I get that big error page and stuff, and that's not really what we want. So I need to get new certificates. I need to replace these files here. I cannot generate these files myself. I could pay money and get these files from someone. Basically, what you do is you do part of that key signing part, and then you send it off to someplace, and then they'll send you back another one. But there's this new thing called Let's Encrypt. It's out of curiosity, how many of you have heard of Let's Encrypt? Not many of you. Okay. Let's Encrypt is a free, automated, and open certificate authority. So we talked about certificate authorities in terms of, you know, okay, there are keys that are trusted. So if I go to, they changed everything around, so let's see if I can find it. Privacy and security. Certificates. View certificates. So by default, Firefox trusts all these certificates. So if I can get one of these organizations to sign my certificate, then I have a trusted certificate in the web, and at least Firefox will do it. And basically, the list of trusted certificate authorities is roughly the same across browsers. They mostly trust the same places. Some of these organizations only sign things that are for the organization, so you can't pay them any money. Some of these other ones are companies and you have to pay the money, but now there's Let's Encrypt and they don't require you to pay anything. But there's one big difference with Let's Encrypt versus these other ones. Most of these other places issue you certificates that are good for at least a year. Let's Encrypt, their certificates are only valid for 30 days. So typically if you're going to use Let's Encrypt, you have to have some automated mechanism to update your certificates. So this is the difference, if you're talking about saying certificate authorities, of if you want to go with the free Let's Encrypt versus some other organization, is I can pay maybe like $20 a year or something, to get them to give me a certificate, and then I just put the files in there and I'm done. Or I set up a program which will periodically update things. So, I'm curious now. So if I'm, what's this? I didn't want to do that. That was an old window. That was a synchronization window. Anyway. So if I look at Let's Encrypt, and I go here, and if you look here, get started. So what it's saying is, we recommend most people with shell access use the certbot Acme client. So this is a program. What is the problem here? So it's saying I should install certbot. I'm running on a Linux distribution. I could download the code from the website. But if you're running on Linux, your first instinct is to say, does my distribution already have this program? Because if they already have the program, it's probably properly configured. So I don't know if certbot's here. So I'm going to search my, but I'm going to check to see, does Ubuntu know about certbot? Search. Transitional dummy pack, certbot, okay. So it has Let's Encrypt. This one says, this is a dummy package from the arena of Let's Encrypt to certbot. It can be safely removed. Okay. So certbot. The objective of certbot, Let's Encrypt, and the Acme Automated Certificate Management Environment protocols to make it possible to set up an HPS server and have it automatically obtain a browser-trusted certificate without any human intervention by running a certificate manager agent on the web server. This agent is used to automatically approve to Let's Encrypt that you control the website, obtain a browser-trusted certificate, and set it up on your web browser, keep track of when your certificate is going to expire and renew it, help you revoke the certificate if it ever becomes necessary. So, install that. Right? Okay. That's a lot of Python. I really find it amazing. This computer is like, that's like a 5-year-old Apple, what's it called? It's a Mac Mini running this. It's like a 5-year-old computer. But I put an SSD in it and it's still pretty fast. It's just desktops. Okay, so certbot's running. Now, what do I do? Does anyone know on Ubuntu systems how you figure out what the heck you do once you've installed a package? Anyone know this little trick? If you go to the user share doc, there's always a directory corresponding to the package. Every package has a directory in user share doc. And in that, there's almost always a README of some kind. What's this say? Wait, this file contains a series of comments that are used to include sections of this README in other files. Do not modify these comments unless you know what you are doing. Okay. Okay, how to use certbot depends on the configuration of web browser. The best way to get started is to use the interactive guide, generates instructions based upon your configuration settings. Okay. You just run certbot auto and the client will guide you through the process of obtaining and installing certs interactively. Huh. Should we try it? Okay, worst I can do, I could blow away my old certificates, but it's not like I care about my old certificates. Well, I could erase my computer completely, but I think I'm okay. So what was that? Okay, let's see. Okay. No, not dot slash, certbot. Auto. What? Okay. That's a lot of options. That's an awful lot of options. Okay. Uh, default run. So if I just run certbot, it may actually do the right thing. Certbot doesn't know how to automatically configure the web server on the system. However, it can still get a certificate for you. Please run certbot cert only to do so. But we know where our certificate files are. I might as well just do that. What was it? It says certbot cert only. Spin up a temporary web server standalone. Place files in the web root directory. Two. Let me just check to see where the web root is. So question. What is it asking me about here? What is this question? Anyone know what this question is talking about?
I assume that it's going to go to your web server to validate that you own it before it gives you the certificate. So your two choices are you already have a web server, which is due, or you're going to start one temporarily just for that procedure to happen.
Exactly. So the key idea of a certificate authority is vouching, in essence, for you. And so it's supposed to only sign the certificate if it's saying, yes, I can give you a certificate for this domain because, yes, you have the domain. I'm not giving it to some other random person. So how do they know that you have that domain? Well, if you can change files in that domain, you probably control it. If you can change files in that domain, you definitely control it. If an attacker controls it, if downer controls it, you think, well, you know, they can do everything. So we have to make our web server serve weird files. And by making our web server serve whatever files it says, it's basically a challenge response. Say, make your web server show this file. And if it does show that file, then they go, okay, yeah, you obviously control that domain. And if we can't do that, then it's like, well, you don't really control that domain, do you? Can't make it do whatever we want, you know. So I'm not saying this is now asking for place files in a web root directory. Now the thing I'm trying to remember is where my web root is. I think it's var www, yes. And sites available. So this is my main one. Document root is var doisomo homies.scs.carlton.ca. That's where my files are. Okay. Wait, is that right? Oh, see, it's soma. By the way, these are owned by me because this is my web server, so it makes sense I just owned it as myself. So I don't have to be in root to do this. Okay, and here's my index file. Which is what happens if you just visit homeostasis at the top level. Other prefixes get other things, like if you go to /wiki, that takes you to the wiki. There's a different redirect in there if you look in the... Where was that? Anyway, doesn't matter. So now I can tell it, I know where to tell it to put files. So select it. Okay, so now enter the email address used for urgent renewal and security notices. soma@scs.carlton.ca. Okay, select an appropriate number. Please use the terms of service. You must agree. Yes, I agree. Would you be willing to share your email address with Electron Frontier Foundation? They already know about me, so please enter your domain names. STASI. Enter the web root. Okay, press 1 to confirm the selection. Plus E.
one. Input the word slash var www/soma. Okay. I typed it in right, I think. Okay. Well known. Huh. I was curious what I put in there. Okay, well known is just an empty directory in there. Okay, but that's they cleaned up but didn't completely clean up. They left a direct thing there. But so now congratulations, your certificate and chain have been saved at Etsy Let's Encrypt Live. Homie as a full chain. Okay, and private key is there. My private key will expire at on May 13th. So it's actually not 30 days, it's actually 90 days. Well, actually 3 months. What does that work out to 90 days because it's February and 28 days and... I'm calculating. Because it's kind of funny because the 13th is tomorrow. Anyway, okay, so to non-enter renew all your runs, serp bot renew. So there's this thing called, so let's see, let's encrypt live. Okay. What's that readme? PrivKey.key is the private key for your certificate. Full chain is the certificate file used in most server software. Chain is used for stapling and Nginx 137. We're not using that. cert.pem will break many server configurations and should not be used without reading further documentation. Okay. So full chain and priv key are probably what I want. So what should I do next?
Go back to your Apache configuration?
Yep, go back to my Apache configuration and have it, we'll leave that in that window. Go to Apache, go to SL. So, I think I should probably just edit this file. But I'll put in here. So just to say, using Let's Encrypt, it's like I could put something else in there, but just something to like go, what? Huh? Oh yeah, right. So
Can you just drag
the sorry. Yeah, no, thank you. That's fine. Okay, so now we're using Let's Encrypt, and now. So, what I'm going to do now is edit the. I'm going to edit my thing, and I'm going to change this. First of all, I don't think I actually. Okay, what's the comment character? Oh, it's pound, of course. So I'm going to comment this out in case I'll just put it there so it's a little more obvious. Okay, and we'll move that. And we'll change this to certificate file should be So here we are. certificate file is /etc/let's encrypt/live/ /what? That's really annoying, actually. I don't like having that big file there. And it also makes it confusing for it. We'll say SSL/cert.pem, and we'll make this that's a nice, easy to remember, easy to understand thing. So I just made these files like this because that way I don't mess with my configuration file. Everything's kind of in the Apache directory, and then I'm going to, yep.
Didn't it say to not use the cert.pem file, to use a different one? Like it was like private key or something?
Oh, yes, full chain. Right, I want to use full chain, right, thank you. No. Right, it was the full chain key, and then and the other one was priv key, right? So I'll just let's try. Okay, ooh, that's not what I want. So now these keys, I'm not going to copy here. I'm going to put in symbolic links, so that they're full chain. Those are definitely old. And we'll just leave the old stuff around. And /let's encrypt live homeostasis priv key to. And then we wanted to. Proof key and full chain two. Right? So I've got those. Proof key, full chain. I think I got them right. So what's left? Restart Apache. Okay, no errors. That's good. And let's go to woohoo! You see the lock icon? And we say what here? Let's view. See, verify by let's encrypt. More information. And the certificate expires on May 13, 2018. Yay! It works. Okay, and we go to /. Okay. Now, what I really should do now is, see, if I click here, I'll continue the wiki, it stays there, but links are gonna go to my old HTTP server. So really, to finish setting this up, I should look to see how do I make my regular connection forward to HTTPS.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't relative links just maintain the same security level?
Relative links, yes. But in particular, so let's say if I go to like my lecture here, and I have this audio here, you notice the link is not, you know, it doesn't. It's going to go to HTTP. So I have to make my HTTP server, instead of serving things, it just has to say, let them take it. How are we doing time-wise? Do I have time? I'll stop there. So you see, that took me about a bit over half an hour to go through. I'm guessing if you're going to try doing something kind of like that, it would probably take you longer. Probably like maybe a couple of hours, 2 or 3 hours. But that would be a great little experience. You know, have a website and set it up. Now, maybe it would be a lot simpler or something. I mean, this was a little more complicated because I had an existing website. I'm not saying you should necessarily do Let's Encrypt. Yes, I mean, but say you're running your own website and it's not as self-protected, it's probably a good thing to do. You know, by this summer, Chrome's going to start labeling everything over HTTP insecure. Say, unless you have a certificate, it's there. Now, the idea that you have to pay in order to get a certificate is, I think, obnoxious. The fact that Let's Encrypt is a good step, but it's like, okay, but it's free, good enough for now. Something else may come along, you know, next year, who knows. Such is the way of technology. I have no problem if you want to do something useful for yourself. It doesn't just have to be a little exercise. But, depends. So now, what I want to play with a little bit is start talking about buffer overflows. And this I'm going to do in the style of an experience, basically meaning that I'm going to do stuff and I don't know if it's going to work. And that's kind of what I want you all to get. It's like, you're going to go into this go like, I'm not sure how to get this working. I may break things and stuff. It's like, fine. Get a virtual machine. Get something that's disposable. It doesn't matter. A lot of these concepts you're only going to understand if you do something hands-on with them. So anytime you have anything that I've talked about that's fuzzy, play with it. You're like, I don't understand what VPNs do. Set up a VPN. Why can't someone VPN into your house? Why not? Allow for connections. See what it would take to do that.
You just have to write a report that you want to be about 4 pages, right?
The report, I mean, when I say, four pages, it's how much... No, I didn't say 4 pages. I thought it's probably a cut.
Two to four.
But again, it's talking about... I mean, if I were just to sit here and write up the things I just did, how many pages would that take up?
Two.
I mean, it'd probably take up at least 2 pages. Just say, not even with screenshots. Just saying that, you know, I went through, I looked at my... I had to figure out where my web root was, and I, you know, did that, and then it asked me this question, and I was trying to figure out... I didn't know what to do there, and I had to go... I mean, just tell about what you did. And tell, that was really nice that it gives all these options, but it's really confusing that it's like, whoa! But... Talk about that experience. Literally, just tell me what... Say, how did it go with setting up your web server? Well, you know, I had to do this, I had to do that, and then this really confused me, and some. How would you tell them about that? That's what I'm looking for. When you say that it's not this big, complicated writing document, it's just blather on about what happened. You know, and tell me, it's like, oh, wow, that's really was simpler than I thought. Or what in the world is this, you know, why are there two files, and why is there one that's a... You know, why is it chain? What's this chain idea? Where does that come from? Nope. There's a lot of questions that potentially should come up in the things that you're looking at. You won't understand everything you do. But then that kind of comes from maybe ask me about it. Maybe do further research. So, what am I going to do now? Let's get out of my Windows. I don't need to be on my machine now. And let's see the other window. Okay. So now let's try talking about buffer overflows. So I've created my new program, victim.c. Actually, it's not really a well, let's call it victim. Young. Let's make a classic C program. Well, it's classic C programs won't do this. Okay, so you have int, we have int main, int argc, character pointer argv. What we're going to do is, well, let's first check to make sure def. Always good to check to make sure your toolchain actually works. What, huh?
You gotta return something.
I don't know if it'll actually give me an error, but that's, you know, I should return something. Return zero. Okay. Works. Hello. So, classic buffer. Let's make a function. Well, let's not do it in main, because main's a little bit weird as a function. So you're better off to say I want to argue. We'll have no arguments for now. Okay, so this will return a number. So target is char buff. So we have a character buffer. Well, we said we have a buffer. The buffer is small, right? So we're going to do scanf is I just give the format and the I expect to receive a string. We'll make it actually sorry. Okay, we'll just do that. Scanf returns integer, so okay. So we have a stupid little function here. Function does it has a small little buffer, it does a scanf, and it says you and it returns what you typed in, and you're done. So let's see if that works. Oh yeah, that helps. Okay, target. We'll say what's up, and we'll return result. Might as well. Why not? Okay. Does scanf do that? Scanf do space? I haven't used scanf in so long because it's such a horrible thing. So let's see now. What is scanf function format described below? So okay, this is the format thing. So H. Sequence of non-white space characters. Okay. Okay, so that's... So actually, by default, you're supposed to give a maximum field width, so that actually checks. But S just takes a sequence of non-white space characters. Okay, that's fine. This is a test. Okay, now... So, what happened there?
Gave it a really long string.
Yeah, it's a really long string, but what happened afterwards? So you typed, this is a really long string, how about that, la la la, and then it says stack smashing detected, unknown terminated, aborted, core dumped. So, first off, we should go, okay, the stack smashing detected, you know, terminated. So it noticed that something went wrong, that we had overflowed the stack. Because what had happened now is we had input more than 20 characters into this buffer. It's only 20 characters long, and we typed in more than 20 characters. And so clearly those characters went somewhere. And you know what's really bad, though? Is look at this. You typed.
After a minute.
It recorded all those bytes. They were written to memory. It's not like you like stop. Oh, you went past the end of the buffer. We stopped. No. It was all written to memory. And when precisely did it detect the smashing? Basically, the way, you know when it detected it? Well, we'll say, let's do a little test. When could it detect? So, and then we'll go here. Okay, so now, so it's a normal case. You typed hello, all good, target finished. You see this. Now we're going to try doing again, and let's just try cutting and pasting this. So, hypothesis. When did it actually detect that things had gone wrong?
When it returned the target.
When it returned from target. It did not figure it out when we blew away memory. Memory was blown away. Memory was corrupted. We detected it once, you know, and other things kept working. We called other functions. You know, we called another call to printf. But when we return from the function that goes, whoa, there's something wrong there, let's return. Does anyone know how the detection happened? Well, first off, at what level was it detected? Who's outputting this message? Is this, specifically, is this coming from user space, or is this coming from the kernel? Thoughts? Let's think of it this way. If this was coming from the kernel, how is it running to our terminal? The kernel can send signals and stuff, but it doesn't directly know about running the terminal. You can have it stick things into the terminal, but that would be very dangerous because you might be sticking things in at a time that would not be good. I mean, the kernel, it can log errors to its log file, but just changing program output is in the sort of very human readable, not
I mean, freeform way, this is not meant for a computer to consume. This is to let a human know something went wrong. So the kernel did not do this. At most, the kernel might be partially responsible, and that, but you need some user space component to do this. So next part of this, how can, so let's say there's at least a user space component. What's it detecting?
What's been detected?
So it's detecting that the stack has been smashed, which means the stack has been corrupted. Data has been written on the stack that is not valid. How can it know that data is now invalid? You know, it has to have some idea of what valid is. It has to have some idea. So what specifically is it?
It's like data that was stored in the buffer. It's kind of like saying.
Well, it can't. Well, it.
Or like.
It'd be very hard to tell exactly what's going to be in the buffer because the buffer is. Who knows what's going to be in it? But why does it have to check the buffer? It doesn't have to check the buffer. The idea of these of this sort of stack smashing defenses is you put patterns into the stack separate from the data. So there's a return address. So there's different techniques for it, and I'm not sure which one actually is being used here. And that actually might be an interesting thing to say. What pattern exactly is being written to the stack to protect against this? So, but something's being written to the stack so that, like, the classic thing is a canary word. And so the canary word is just some random little bit of, you know, thing that's put into memory between all the local variables and the return address. Because remember, when C functions, in order to return to the caller, have to place the return address onto the stack. And that's the idea of a buffer overflow attack, the classic one, is if you overwrite that return address, you jump to anywhere you want in the program on function return. The attacker has to be able to guess what that return address is. But if it's a standard binary, it's a standard layout, you know, you can guess that. So what this does is it puts some defense. Now, some of the ones now, the modern ones, also do things to transform the return address. So the return address isn't the normal return address, it's been transformed by some way, like XOR with some pattern or something, and then on return, before doing the return, it puts it back to the way it is. So that the raw return address isn't even on the stack. Again, cat and mouse game, you know, arms race, these defenses have become relatively sophisticated. But this is from actually the compiler. The compiler has built this in and modified the binary to put this sort of protection on there, so that if something corrupts the stack, it will detect it at runtime and do this. So if I actually want to do a buffer overflow attack, I gotta get around that. Now, since we're just trying to get something running, now, if you're a real attacker, you'd actually have to get past that defense. And most of the time, you don't actually get past that defense. You try attacking a buffer that isn't protected by it. Because this specifically is good for the stack. The heap is another story. And there are heap protectors, but it's hard to do something. The layout of the stack is very standard. You know exactly what you need to protect. The heap, it's like, okay, what am I protecting? Okay, maybe there's a function pointer here and stuff. The compiler-based things can't do that because it also changes how memory is laid out in the heap. In the heap, you kind of normally have to know what things look like. I mean, there, malloc can do some protections, and I think modern ones do, but yeah, I'd have to check that. So this is part of the thing is, in order to do buffer attacks nowadays, the easiest way is you have to go through and figure out what defenses you have to disable.
So is the stack smashing defense, is that specific to GCC?
Yes.
but most modern C compilers have similar defenses.
Okay.
So, stack protector. I would just warn, this is optional. Only active when fstack protector, with functions that are not protected against stack smashing. Okay. So stack protector, I think it's something like dash F, no stack. Oh, look. So if F stack protector strong is nailed by default, if none of dash. So no stack protector. Okay, that's all good. So, no longer is it detecting it. Defense, gone. Now notice now, if I did, oh, there's no warnings.
Yeah. So, so now we get into something, another level of protection memory thing. So, what does segmentation fault mean? Who generates that? Right, the actual text was produced by, of course, it comes from the user space. But who detected this? And what specifically was happening?
That's a kernel signal.
That's a kernel, yes. That's a signal from the kernel. Specifically, you're wondering, well, what sort of signal?
So I just did strace, so it outputs all the system calls as well. So it did thing, and then you see sig seg v was received. And that's why the message was printed. So the kernel sent the process a segmentation violation signal. What's a segmentation violation signal?
It's a memory in. Basically, like, memory outside of the program was supposed to use was accessed.
Exactly. Memory outside of the program's allocation was used. So you have this giant address space, especially on modern systems. You have 64-bit address space. Huge space. Most of that is not valid memory. On a modern operating system, every process has its own address space. This is stuff you should have learned in operating systems. You have page tables to map the addresses for each process. So that you have a virtual address space for each process that is mapped to the physical address space. That map is sparse. Only certain parts of it are defined. The parts that are defined are allocated. Remember, the parts that are not are invalid. A segmentation violation basically is the kernel saying, hey, you just tried accessing memory that I did not give you. So, not cool. And so, but all that means is you get a signal sent, the process can intercept that. A process can intercept that signal and say, and choose to do something with it. It doesn't have, but the default handler in C, when you receive that signal, causes you to crash. And with this message, segmentation fault or done.
I'm curious. Which application? I'm curious, is it saying this strace? Don't send a problem. Everything's fine.
See, Ubuntu actually, you know, modern operators have things to detect when you start dumping core all over the place. They go like, hey, someone got a segmentation violation. That's probably a bug in a program, so we better report that upstream. Wouldn't they like to know about that crash? But that's all that's happening. So it's, and so what does it mean, core dump? What is core? This is a very, very archaic term. Core comes from core memory, i.e. the old memory type that they used to use in old mainframes and minis and stuff. So when it says core dump, it just means that it's written memory out. Now, by default on modern systems, the size of the core dump file is set to 0, so you don't actually have core dump files generated. But if you enable that and set the core dump file size, you know, to something, you know, I forget what value you set it to. But then you can get core dump files, which basically is an image of the process that crashed. And so you can go into that process image and see what the state of memory is. Because basically it's just taking all the memory of the process and written it to disk. Because who knows, you might be able to find something interesting in there.
It's probably easier when your system didn't have 16 gigs of RAM.
Yeah, exactly. Now your core dump files could be rather, rather large. And let's face it, most people working on systems are not debugging the programs they're on. You know, Unix came from originally from a, you know, the person using the computer was a developer. Unix was a system design. Unix is a giant IDE. It's kind of funny when I say integrated development environments. The first IDE really was Unix, as far as my concern, because it was an operating system designed for developers. That was the consumer of it. And so many of the features of it are really developer-friendly. For a certain definition of developer.
Yeah, for a certain amount of sophistication. But anyway, we've got this program here. It's crashing. So in principle, what do I have to do? Yeah. So one thing you could do is say target. So this is not target. Let's call this, instead of this being target, we're going to call this as we'll call this innocent, because this one is definitely innocent. It's just think no one would give me too much. Would give me too much code here. And then I'm going to make target. So now I'm going to create this function target. I'm not going to put any call to it. But this code is in the binary. And what I want to have happen is for you to type in a string that causes the program to jump to target. That's what I want to do. It's type in a string that allows me to jump to target. That's what it means to that. That's probably the simplest kind of buffer overflow to execute. The more classic, sophisticated buffer overflow to do is to in your buffer you don't just overwrite the return address to jump to an arbitrary location. You put overwrite the return address and you put code in the buffer. And so you actually jump into the buffer and then start executing that code. That code is called shell code, because classically it would give you a command shell. Because if you have a root command shell, you can do whatever you want. That doesn't tend to work on modern systems for a very simple reason. The stack is normally marked as no execute. So I could disable no execute stack. Yeah, but if I want to do this, I don't need to do that. I just need to disable stack smashing protection. Because this will now allow me to, because now I can still overwrite the stack, the return address has to be on the stack. And so by overwriting this, I just
could, but.
But it's not quite so simple. So let's try it and. Okay, so the program works still. And if we. So now if I'm going like, well, I'm probably going to have to give it some binary values. So how will I give it its binary values? Well, I just put it in a file and redirect standard input. If I redirect standard input and set it into there, then I'm fine. But what number should I use? How much space should I use? Well, more specifically, I clearly don't have that memorized. I'll have to figure it out. What tools could I use to figure it out?
Maybe strace.
Strace tells me system calls, but you're close.
Info registers and
GDB. You want to use GDB now to mess with it and figure out what's happened with memory. Now, if I okay, so no debugging. Oh, well, no, we probably won't have very simple. So, so see, it works on the debug. So now we're gonna do. I want to add a breakpoint. How do you add a breakpoint again? Okay. You can specify a symbol, type B for breakpoint, and so now if I do run, so now it's innocent. So I'm at here, I just go next, which has no line and bridge, okay? Single stepping until exit, okay, which has no line number information. So you debug. So one thing, it's good to try doing this without debugging information. You've added debug. If you compile it with dash G, you would actually get more symbols. It's okay if you do it with that. Yes. Okay. Break. Okay. So now we have symbols. So now we have. Right now I count. So right now before this, and I want to say, what's the address of buff? Help data. I want to not dump, disassemble, call, append. God, it's been a long time since I've done this. So, one of these things here will tell me the address. So what I want to know is, if I just say buff. Examine, no. No. Anyway, so if I can, at this prompt, if I can remember how to do it, which actually I'm about out of time, so I don't really have, I should wrap this up here. We maybe continue this next time. But this is actually right here where I've gotten to. This would be a great experience. As you can see, this is going to take you some time in doing to try to figure out how to do this. And you're welcome to share with each other on how to do this. I have great resources on how to recommend for this. There's this wonderful article called Stack Smashing for Fun and Profit. It's a classic text in this, kind of the original, how to do a buffer overflow. It walks you through it, telling you exactly what to do. It's a bit old, and I will tell you there's one thing that... So the basic idea is you find the address here of it,
and then you'd overwrite the address many times in the memory. However, there is one problem you will find, which you're going to have to circumvent in order to actually make this work. Anyone know about address-based randomization? So the address-based randomization thing is designed specifically to defeat this attack. It's a kernel-level protection, which you can turn off. And specifically, what's going to happen is when you go into GDB and you find the address of buff. So if you know the address of buff, what you're really looking for is once you figure out the address of buff, you can then look at the address and disassemble it, and then look to see where the return address is. It's going to be so many bytes from this address, because you're going to start writing at the beginning of this buffer, and you keep running past the return address. And so you figure out where it is, as you know, okay, I have to type in this many characters, 20 characters, plus some number of other characters that are sitting there, and then I'll get to the return address, and I can override it. When you overwrite the return address, you're expecting the return address to be have some sort of standard layout. It turns out it changes on every program execution. So doesn't matter, you'll be able to find the address here, but then you do this GDB and you'll get another address. At least that's what should happen. If it doesn't happen, then, although I'm not actually sure if that happens in GDB. GDB might turn it off. But that's what you have to do. That. So you don't have to turn off the address-based randomization in order to, you know, finally do this. Anyway, this is the start of buffer overflows to get you an idea of the complexity. And it's not such a simple thing. When people say buffer overflows are simple, they're not that simple.
Were they originally produced?
Even here now, this is the original. I'm trying to go through the process of the original one. It's still kind of archaic. I mean, not archaic, esoteric. But modern ones, orders of magnitude harder for reasons we will talk about later. Okay. See you Wednesday.